now pushing buttons. Not sure which ones. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. Well, I'd like to talk to you about koans, paradoxes, and faith. First, koans. So many of you know what a koan is, but probably not everybody. So let me briefly say that koans are riddles. They're inventions, little mind tricks. They're like a little Jedi mind trick. What they're intended to do is kind of stupefy the people who get them. Like, and then they go, well, what happened? So that's kind of what a koan is. So it's a riddle. It can be take different forms. Sometimes the form of a paradox, but it's intended to frustrate your thinking. So we don't do koans in Soto Zen, our style, this school, which I think that's a good thing. But I did have an experience years ago with some koan study. And I sort of felt like I had been given a Jedi mind trick. Sort of a trip, I guess, too. Kind of frustrated how to address it, how to answer it. Every time I answered something, the answer was wrong. And so that's how it went for a while. And then one day I got a tip from a teacher. He said, "Open your mouth and you're already wrong." So those are words I remember. Open your mouth, you're already wrong. So I thought I would tell you that at the outset of my talk tonight, so you can remember if I'd said something wrong or stupefying or just stupid, you can remember that I was forewarned that if you open your mouth, you're already wrong. So the Zen literature, as you read the Zen literature, you'll see oftentimes a reference made to the great matter. You'll see that usually in capital letters, great matter. And as you read in Zen literature, you'll see that that's usually described as trying to understand or penetrate birth and death. That's the great matter. How do you come to peace? How do you understand? How do we deal with birth and death? But I'd like to suggest, in my humble opinion, that birth and death is really the second place great matter. It's kind of like the runner-up great matter. And so then, well, you might say, well, okay, so what's number one? So number one great matter, I'd suggest, is what are you? What are you? That's the great matter. You solve that, then birth and death will be no problem. So let's talk a little bit about what are we. So I have a quotation. I want to read a few quotes tonight, and I'll talk extemporaneously too. There's a quote from a Pali text, very old text of the Buddha. We confuse ideas about what we are with the truth of what we are. We believe the body is ours, and we are very attached to it. Because of this, we magnify the importance of two events, birth and death. But birth and death occur in a stream of events. They are not the beginning or end of what we really are. Nice quote. Okay, well, that still raises the issue. Well, what are we? If we're not ideas about ourselves, still, what are we? And this makes me think of something that Les frequently says. I've heard him say this many, many times over the years. Something like, Zen is a spiritual practice. Well, over those years, as I heard him say that, I kept my mouth shut, but I was thinking, what does that really mean? What does spiritual practice mean? Because, so spiritual practice, so that means there must be a spirit. And like, well, okay, where is it? How do I find it? And not that I thought, no, that can't be right, but I had, like I'm sure all of us, way-seeking mind, it had some sort of intuition that it might be right, but nevertheless, I couldn't say it was right. I just didn't know. And so when you hear, let's say something like, Zen is a spiritual practice, you might, like myself, just be skeptical. You're not sure. I was actually trained as a scientist, so I'm looking for, you know, some sort of evidence, something. So so spiritual practice, Zen is a spiritual practice. Well, there's some other words, just to interchange some words tonight. So what are other words we use for spirit? I think sometimes emptiness, Buddha nature, original face, the unborn, God, and so on. Many names like that that you've heard. So Zen is a spiritual practice. Well, how do we get past that skepticism? How do we get to a place where we feel it's true, understand it's true? And that's where the practice really comes in. So I want to read two passages from Dogen that may help us get pointed in the right direction. Once while in China, I was reading a collection of sayings by an ancient master. At that time, a monk from Sichuan, who was a sincere practitioner of the way, asked me, "What's the use of reading all these sayings?" I replied, "I want to learn the deeds of the ancient masters." The monk asked, "What is the use of that?" I said, "I will teach people after I return home." The monk asked, "Ultimately, what is the use?" Later, I considered this and thought, learning the deeds of ancient masters by reading recorded sayings or koans or explaining them to deluded people, these are all ultimately of no use for my practice nor for teaching others. Even if I don't know a single letter, I will be able to show it to others in inexhaustible ways if I devote myself to just sitting and clarify the great matter. For this reason, the monk said to me, "Ultimately, what is the use?" I thought this to be the truth. Thereupon, I gave up reading the recorded sayings and other texts, concentrated wholeheartedly upon sitting, and was able to clarify the great matter. So this is a bit of a paradoxical passage from Dogen, especially those of you who know that Dogen was a prolific writer. He wrote many, many things, very gifted, insightful teacher, great teacher. But it's also, in some ways for me, his most important writing, which is don't get attached to the words, don't get too much. Texts and talks can be okay, but you get too much, you get sick. It just clouds your mind. It just makes you stupefied. So just practice Zazen. That was his message. And then one more passage I'd like to read of Dogen's. He's talking in the context about mind and body, knowing that mind and body are not really two things, but sometimes we talk like that. But it can be useful. So koans, for example, are kind of mind tricks. So this is his passage. As long as we only think about the Buddha Dharma with our minds, The way will never be grasped, even in a thousand lifetimes or myriad of eons. When we let go of our minds and cast aside our views and understanding, the way will be actualized. Ryun, for example, clarified true mind when he saw peach blossoms. And Kyogen realized the way when he heard the sound of a piece of tile hitting a bamboo. They attained the way through their bodies. Therefore, we completely cast aside our thoughts and views and practice Zazen. We will become intimate with the way. For this reason, there is no doubt that the way is attained through the body. That is why I encourage you to practice Zazen wholeheartedly. So again, another message about the body and not the mind. So Dogen's very clear, as many teachers have been, that Zazen is central to our practice. And that Zazen, especially after you've sat for 40 minutes and maybe you're not used to it, you realize Zazen is a very physical practice. It's very much about our body. And so that's okay. That's what we do when we practice Zazen. We let go of our thoughts. They come up, we let them go. They come up, we let them go. But we stay with our body. So that's an important message that we hear from all of our teachers. But I want to make one additional point. In particular, I'm going to advocate that Zazen, we need something else in addition to Zazen. And that is faith. And so let me explain why I say that. And it also might be easier, perhaps, if you interchange the word trust or confidence with faith. You can use them interchangeably. So the concept of faith in Zen Buddhism is a bit paradoxical as well. Because in general, you see Buddhism, Zen Buddhism in particular, talking about like, hey, you know, accept no dogma. Let go of all these ideas. So faith is usually kind of seen like, oh, I gotta hold on to these things, you know. And at the same time, we're being told, let go of these things. So that's kind of a paradox, at least at the surface. The Zen teacher Sengstan wrote a poem, and there's a line in that poem, do not search for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. So that's a strong statement. Do not seek the truth. Just cease to cherish opinions. So to say we should have faith does seem paradoxical if we're being told that we shouldn't search for the truth. In contrast, most religions that we know of, maybe, for example, that might read the Bible or the Quran, faith is a central requirement. There are certain teachings, this is how the world is structured, here are certain stories that are important that explain this and part of our history, and you should remember them, understand them, and believe them and accept them, and that's the faith. So faith is really believing these notions, the teachings, and the stories. So if we do not search for the truth, what does faith mean in the context of Zen Buddhism? It means that it's not about specific ideas, but about trusting ourselves. We don't need ideas, we don't need words, we just need to trust ourselves, have faith in ourselves, that our nature is true and we're part of it and we can't escape that, not that we would want to, but there's no reason to look outside It's not around the corner. It's not waiting for us next year. It's right here today. So faith is trusting ourselves, not accepting ideas. And if you can have a confidence that you can feel in your bones, that's true faith. So one more quotation. This is from the same Zen teacher, Sengstan, who had his poem is called Faith Mind. He said the following. To come directly into harmony with suchness, just simply say when doubt arises, not to. In this not to, nothing is separate, nothing is excluded. To live in this faith is the road to non-duality, because the non-dual is one with a trusting mind. So, trusting mind is confidence, sitting with confidence, not worrying about we're doing it right or wrong, just sitting with confidence. So I want to urge you, all of us, have faith, have trust and confidence, and that way we can relax, be serene in the oneness of things. Thank you. Any comments or questions?
Thank you for your words tonight. I was wondering if you heard the phrase, great faith, great doubt, great effort. And what do you think that means in the context of your talk?
Well, even though we're all perfect, this is a Suzuki Roshi saying that I'm paraphrasing. Even though we're all perfect, we must make ceaseless effort. So it's our nature to do this. It's not something we have to because somebody told us we had to. It feels natural. So I think that's a ceaseless effort. Doubt arises. And people, you can use doubt. You can use it in koans, but doubt arises because we have deluded views, so that we get confused. And by deluded views, I don't mean delusional, like, you know, I'm Napoleon, but rather that, you know, what we think of as everyday thinking, you know, I'm me and I got this and this is yours and this is how things work together and we're separate. I think it's easy to have doubt. It comes up. And I think that's what Sengstan was saying. So when doubt arises, because it's gonna, I'll just say not to. And so that's the great faith, if you can just rely on that.
You brought up non-dualism, right?
Say again?
You were talking about non-dualism.
That's in that quote, yes.
Yeah. I understand where non-dualism comes from, and we're not separated from what is, whatever it is. But the way that society is, the way that people are, the way that where we live, the where we, how we are existing in this world right now, there's nothing else but duality. People come and talk to me at work, and they'll talk down to me because I'm not an engineer, I'm not computer programmer. And they don't treat me with the same amount of respect. So what has happened to me is like I've started looking back at them and I don't treat them with respect. I just treat them just like another entity. They just, you know, you're here to do something, I'm here to do something. Somebody was getting on, you know, somebody was talking down to me and I stopped them right then and then I said, look, I just work here. Stop. I just had to completely take a stand in front of them. And when I did that, it was just very unnerving for that person. They didn't know how to, they were like, no, I said stop. You really need to stop right now. Because if you don't, I will call security on you. But this is how we are, people. And I used to see that when I worked at San Francisco State, that I would send a student over to a department of physics or chemistry or engineering, and the student would have a Spanish accent, an African accent, a Thai accent, any kind of accent, and they would turn around and send it. But that student backed me to the international student's office. But it was this sense of duality that they had, that this person is not like them, or this person is something that they have to make an effort towards, to talk to listen to. So they weren't willing to do that. They would turn around and send it back to me, and then I had to send them back to them and say, look, if you don't listen to the student, then I have to come down and talk to you, and I have to talk to, you know, human resources and tell them that you're not doing your job. So it's like, it's almost like you kind of sort of have to, I don't like using that word, but scare people a little bit, you know, to knock them out of their reality. But this is where we live, and this is how things are, and this is how people are. It's understandable that we talk about this non-duality, but duality exists in life. And people have a tendency of only seeing one side of things. They don't see the other person as another person. But I'm starting to see more and more and more and more is people are so concerned with what they are saying to the other person, they don't listen to the other person. And I have to constantly stop myself. I have to stand there and listen to myself and go, no, you're not going to talk to yourself when the other person is talking to you. You are going to listen to yourself, listen to this person, because this is what your job is. This is what you have to do. Because you are here to solve a problem for this person. You're not here to, you know, show off in front of this person. You're not here to do this kind of showing off. We're here to, you know, I've been paid to solve a problem. But this duality that and non-duality play goes on all the time. You know, we talk about non-duality, but we don't really practice it. And there's a disconnect that has happened, and it is happening more and more, where I see people talk about spirituality, but they don't really practice spirituality in their lives. And why do you think this happens?
I can't tell you why exactly we're all born so ignorant, but it does seem to be that way. And the way we're growing up, the way the mind works, I'm not sure, but pretty soon we have ideas that I'm this and you're that, and that's mine and this is yours, and this is good and that's bad, and I like that and I don't like that. And so we get conditioned. We get conditional thinking. And that's more common than not. So most everybody you meet is inconditional thinking. That's deluded thinking. That's the, what a Buddhist scripture would say about that. So that's not, it shouldn't surprise you, right? I mean, that's kind of how people are. They tend to be deluded. That doesn't mean they're stupid. It doesn't mean that they're crazy. It means that they see the world in certain thinking ways. So always is thinking, right? So when you put it down, that's what the practice is about. So, but also we can practice compassion, even at times it seems most difficult. When somebody's talking down to you, when somebody cuts you off on the freeway, when somebody gives you the smaller half of the sandwich, whatever it is, we can practice compassion. It's an opportunity. So, because they're not trying to be deluded. We're not trying to be deluded. It's just the conditional thinking makes us act in these ways. Yes, Francis.
Omar, I want to share some things with you. If it's useful, I can keep talking, otherwise we can get into shut up. So I've been running some experiments on myself for various reasons. If I model my entire brain without getting into words like small mind and big mind, I want to avoid all of that, and just model my brain as for what it is, which is a general purpose computer, I find that my thoughts, forms, whether they're regarding small mind or big mind, typically fall into two categories. The first category I call the me channel, so I'm watching TV, I'm watching me. And me is kind of a fascinating program because its core assumption is that you are finite, time is finite, you don't want time, so, for all practical purposes, you need to get your act together. So it's a little like a stockbroker. It's always trying to sell you the future. So what happens when those people treat you the way they were treating you is a bartering system gets established in your brain where not only is your own present time not valuable in terms of someone else's future, but you're also trying to figure out how to use other people's present time to service your own future needs. Dick, are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
So neither you or the other person is present at that point in time because you know, you're both sort of caught in this messiness of the future. The reason this is dangerous is actually what starts happening is, I'm only speaking for myself. What I've started noticing is that these programs, the programs that believe in finite time, these programs develop a natural negotiation capability. They're always sort of trying to con me into getting a little more of my present time. Because they need to run these more complicated future programs. I can go into explaining why that is. It has to do with the fact that my mind is a general purpose computer, as opposed to a very specialized computer like an app. There's another channel, which I'm starting to explore more. I call that the B channel, because it's rather than, on the Me channel, it was like a single standalone computer. And the behaviors that a standalone computer has with another standalone computer is always one of trying to establish a slave-master relationship. And we essentially barter time, or the assumption that time is infinite, is not finite. It's not infinite. To play that game. On this other channel, which I notice when I go out in my backyard and play with my cat and watch what he's doing, everything is completely infinite. So if I look at you and I talk to you from that perspective, I don't really barter with you anymore. So all this one-upmanship and big-upmanship kind of goes away. And it's hard, I understand what you were saying, that this person is operating in the bartering phase and you're trying to operate in the infinite, abundant phase. least try to make him more aware of that, then it's not easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer, but I do know that if you can switch back and forth between me and me, you kind of develop a reality which is kind of like me, you know, like my cat. And it is actually, if I look at all the living beings that I come into contact with, I see that animal, some ants, are very much in the we world. I mean, you know, they'll fight to save their queen or whatever else they do.
Mm-hmm.
On the other extreme, I, as a human being, because of the fact that I have this genetic distributor and all the costs of maintaining this very expensive machinery, I'm mostly in the we world. I have a sense of the we world only when I can shut down certain processes. And sitting is one of those ways of doing it. When you come across situations like what you just did, the only thing you can do, I feel, is to see if you can somehow interact with this person and bring them into the we world. Because the moment he's in the we world and you're in the we world, nothing good can come out of it. Because you're working on a false assumption. The false assumption is that time is finite. What's worse, you're assuming that you, in some way, can change the future based on how much time you spend in the present.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's Corey.
So when I hear these last few questions, I guess what comes to mind for me is that it starts to look really appealing to just like quit my job and give up my stuff and like do zazen all day. Like that actually, that sounds like a great thing to do. But a lot of people here are, you know, obviously not doing that. And I realize you can't tell me like what the value is for me in not doing that like right now. But could you maybe talk about what value you find in kind of sticking around and maybe how we can find value in a social structure, a national structure where this kind of thinking is not necessarily encouraged.
That the thing that's not encouraged is quitting your job and sitting zazen all the time. Is that?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Buddha spoke about right livelihood as part of the Eightfold Path, and because if we all sat zazen and nobody did anything else, like it'd be an interesting world, wouldn't it? Yeah, so it's okay to work. Work is fine. In fact, Zen saying is no work, no eat. So working is fine. It has a place. And retreats are good. And some people want to really decide, you know, it's best for me to dedicate my life in the spiritual path. And they go to a monastery. That's good too. But it's also good to go out and work in the world. It doesn't mean one's better than the other. It doesn't mean that you can't have a clear mind at work or in a monastery. So really, the monastery exists within us. It's not a building somewhere else. It's the present moment. It's the present opportunity. Ms. Todd.
Thank you, Chris, for your talk. I can want to say it's the first time I've heard you speak like this, and most of what I know of you is in the sitting and your understatement of the physicality and being in Sashin I feel connected to. In a special way, as I do with many people here who we sit in silence. That's how I mainly know you and admire But I'm very curious. I mean, there is a bizarre paradox in that you're saying you're talking. Right. You're giving this where you're talking. So, I mean, it's like, and I'm sitting here listening, so can I do that? So, I'm very curious about language and how its function is less eloquent speaker, writer. But I'm also very, it is a strange paradox of the sitting and this speaking. And so, as I've been listening to Francis, I mean, my God, it's like, wow, I think I have an extra layer of bone in my head or something. Well, that's intense. To follow it, I need a repeat or something. But, you know, there's these ways in which the words, these structures in which the words come out, the way that it seems like for me that work the best is in poetry and in oxymorons, you know, to explain things. You know, an oxymoron. So, anyway, it's been off on a whole bunch of this. But what my question is I'm not quite sure what is meant by duality. Sometimes what came to mind was two gunslingers, you know, a duel. But in context, I'm wondering if language in general is dualistic. But I don't really know exactly what dualism is, so I'm just throwing out that colon.
Right. So then I have to remember, open your mouth and you're already wrong.
I feel like that seems to work a lot for me,
yeah.
But not tonight.
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually wasn't a joke when I was told that. That was like a real tip. This is what you're supposed to do. Keep your mouth shut when you're asked the koan and do something else that demonstrates that you're present. Words are, I mean, I don't know, almost like you said, they're part and parcel of dualism in the sense that they have compartments in our brain and they have certain definitions and there's synonyms and there's antonyms and there's grammatical structure and everything is organized in a certain way and meanings can be subtle, can be double, can be all kinds of things, but they tend to engage conditional thinking or that kind of thing. But to be, Sengstan in his poem says, at one point, it's not like you should like hate or avoid ideas or people or things, but rather to be totally accepting of them is actually the way. So we can live in the world of words and ideas. The danger is when we lose sight of what they do and we get caught in our thinking and attached to our thinking. So, but really, you don't need words to understand, but words, whether they're spoken or written, can be helpful, right? That's why people write books and people give talks. But like that first passage in Dogen, small doses are probably the best thing. So, and I'm sure I have not answered your question. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So, recently I borrowed a book from the library. It's about Bodhidharma. And it's one of his surviving documents. It's not a thick book, it's very thin. And I was reading it. It took me many weeks to go through it because I couldn't read too much at one go, and not much got inside. But there was one particular section which appealed to me a lot, and I found I was shocked actually. I'm not easily shocked, but when I read that, I was actually shocked that I could be so deluded because it clarified things. And it's said that, you know, Buddha nature is not knowing that, is not obviously being in the dualistic thinking, but it's neither being in non-dualistic thinking. It's in being either in dualistic or non-dualistic and still not being affected by it. So it kind of brought this third state in your mind. We are not influenced by either of these things, right? And I mean, that was a big shock to me that I can realize that, and that's like a big step, because, you know, obviously I'm trying to go from the dualistic thinking to the non-dualistic thinking, and it's very hard, but I realize how far away I have come, that, you know, I have to go here and then I have to go to this other place, right? So, but I found that very clarifying in the sense that you are basically overthinking it, right? Either place, but basically overthinking it.
Sure.
So I found that very useful. And maybe, you know, it applies to what Umar was talking about. So, yeah, just wanted to share.
Thank you.
When you talked about the opportunity to practice compassion, I was wondering if you found in your practice that compassion is something that kind of arises naturally through sitting, or is it something that we need to actively cultivate or encourage in ourselves in some way?
Very good question. I think both. I think it does arise naturally. I think we're all compassionate people intrinsically. But sometimes we cover that up because we're too selfish, because we got me to take care of. And so I don't have time for you. I just have time for me. And so that kind of gets in the way. And so I think it's intrinsic, but I think we can also work to develop it. Yes.
That exact question came up at a talk that I went to in a city center some months back, and it was quite an extended discussion of that exact point by the author of a book called The Six Perfections, talking about the Paramitas. He was very much presenting the opinion that compassion is something that must be cultivated. And the opposite side of the discussion was, you know, compassion is always present and you simply have to uncover it in order to express itself. And I can't reproduce the entire discussion here, but it is a very profound question, and there used to be a lot of discussion at the city center. Chris, I wanted to say how much I appreciate your discussion about faith in heaven as being confidence rather than dogmatic beliefs. And it seems to me that and I think this is what you meant too, that there's more to that than simply a choice. Do I want confidence or do I want dogmatic beliefs? People seem to have this hunger for that feeling of confidence. But the typical way that it seems to be presented, at least in Western spiritual practices, is the confidence arises from first signing up to a bookload of dogmatic beliefs, some of which are very sort of consoling. And then, based on those beliefs and that consolation, then you may have faith that your life will be okay. And in Zen, we sort of bypass the whole notion of the dogmatic beliefs. And through our practice, we can establish confidence in our true nature while facing life as it actually is, as opposed to, I mean, like Stephen Batchelor famously said, the main thing about Buddhism is it's not a religion of consolation. That's one of the real challenges, for example, is to achieve that faith without having to sign up to a whole passive comforting dogma that you can sort of fall back on and say, yes, I'll just hold on to this as tightly as I can. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate your pointing out.
Well, Well, it's sort of like a lot of teaching is intended to jar you, to somehow trip you up a little bit, get you off your comfort zone. I'm certainly not the first to say that, this at all, but I did like to use, the idea was to use faith to bring a little paradox, bring a little uncertainty into it. But thank you. So yeah, it's not about believing in ideas, it's about your own experience. All right, thank you. Yes?
I wanted to share two things about compassion. Somebody asked about that. And these are a couple of things that I observed and I read. So I like to read, and I really love the way this guy Osho, he put something about compassion. And he says that when a child is born, the child is full of creativity, full of compassion, full of great desires. But as the child keeps growing up, the society, the parents, they say that, hey, shit, behave yourself. Hey, sit down. And somehow you just get molded, you know, unless your parents also foster, because, you know, you are like a little sapling. Somebody's giving you water and minerals so that you slowly become a strong tree with deep roots. So I think you said the right thing, that there has to be two approaches. A, it's within you, and somebody mentioned that, you know, we kind of, like, as we grow older, and there's so much going on, as somebody mentioned, that, oh, at work, people are, could be so, like, narrow vision, you know, that, oh, I need this thing to be done, so therefore I do not care about the other person. So I think awareness at every level, being conscious, I think that helps a lot. But also fostering these values from the get-go, you know, as a child, I think that's really important. I recently published an article on LinkedIn about how can we abolish bullism, bullish nature in the schools, how can we remove terrorism and so on. But I kind of narrowed it down to just one example. I see the tree in my backyard, you know, it's really robust. You know, rain comes, wind blows, maybe a branch or two breaks down, but then the tree, you know, is like next day morning, the tree is like, hey, dude, how are you? It just smiles at me, you know? And if you look a little deeper, the way I look at this is, at some point, the tree was very weak, you know, it was really weak because it was a tiny little sapling. The roots were not deep within the soil. So I think that as time passed by, the tree got a lot of nourishment, a lot of water, and the roots kept on going deeper and deeper. I think that's how us human beings, our values also could, you know, grow. Like over a period of time, if we keep on practicing, the power of practice is amazing. Remember when we were kids, we would see the A for apple, B for whatever, blah, blah. And we just continued that, and one day we just learned. So I feel that duality in this approach, like, you know, A, we have it within ourselves, and B, keeping ourselves reminding, like, again and again, that we need to be better at this. I think that helps.
Yeah, thank you. There's no doubt that, I mentioned conditional thinking, there's no doubt that we get conditioned. You know, our environment, how we're raised, it starts, yeah, very early age, how we're raised, and whether it, not just our parents, but the people around us, and schools. And if you think about it, it's pretty scary what a lot of people have to live with. There's all kinds of experiences. You know, that little tree, that little seedling may have been dropped down in the wrong place. Maybe there's a much bigger tree over it that's shading it all the time. It can't get light. Or maybe it has a much better environment. So same with people. The environment that people are in makes a big difference.
Excuse me.
So the leg cramp. Anyway, thank you. Thank you so much for that. And it's about 9 o'clock, so that's probably a good time to stop for the evening, especially since my leg is cramping up. I got to get out of this seat. So, but I'll make it for another minute or two. Anyway, thank you so much for your attention.
We have some jackets over here. I keep forgetting to announce that. So if they're yours, please take them home. It's like we're starting to get a collection. And it's also somebody's, I think, shawl or some scarf that women would wear. It's hanging right here. Have a look and see. And I announced that jackets and that was taken.